You're listening to West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Earlene McMichael. Coming up, I interview philanthropist and award-winning musician Peter Buffett. The son of billionaire Warren Buffett was in Kalamazoo recently for an invitation-only performance. Peter Buffett's Novo Foundation marks 10 years next year of fighting inequities and violence against girls and women. Welcome to WMUK, Mr. Buffett.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
I understand that in 2010, you had a book that is a New York Times bestseller. It's called Life is What You Make It, Find Your Own Path to Fulfillment. What is that about?
Well, what would happen more often than not is people would meet me and they say at some point, you're Warren Buffett's son. You're so normal. And I certainly took that as a compliment growing up in the Midwest. And I knew my story. I knew why I appeared to be normal for people who sort of projected what I would, you know, what I must be like based on being my father's son, my father being Warren Buffett, for those that actually don't know that. And so I realized that by telling my story, I might be able to redefine what privilege and wealth and success really mean.
So it's autobiographical.
It is, although I extend my own story into other people's stories. So it's not just about me, but I'm the springboard to tell, other stories of people who have made it in ways, made it meaning having a fulfilled life, a joyful life, a life that feels like it's their own in different ways that might be unexpected.
Who do you gear that book toward?
So there's a lot of people, I think, that feel like because of what society tells them, they have to follow this path, they have to do it this way, whether it's parental pressure, pressure from friends. And so I would say it's geared towards kids that are maybe going into college and thinking, why am I doing what I'm doing? What do I really want to do? Who am I? But also people in sort of a midlife crisis of sorts, saying, boy, I lived my life this way because I thought I was supposed to. And here I am at 40 or 50 or 60 thinking, who am I really? And what do I really want to do?
So it's a message about being your authentic self.
Yeah, exactly.
While the world knows about your father, Warren Buffett, today, when you were growing up, people didn't really know. It was mostly people in financial circles who knew that. So
right.
Was that kind of a blessing in disguise for you?
It was a blessing not in disguise. In retrospect, it was definitely well disguised at the time. And I think that's the biggest misconception. People see my father now and assume that's who I grew up with. And of course, in a lot of ways it is. And that's the point too. But I grew up going to public school. I had the same English teacher my mother had at Central High in Omaha.
What was your father's expectation of you? My understanding is he allowed his children to be what they wanted to be.
Exactly. I mean, what he was a living example of was what he was hoping we would become as well, which is to say, follow your bliss. You know, it's a classic Joseph Campbell line, right? Follow who you are. Take the time to figure that out. And he wasn't saying, take the time because I'll write you a check. He was saying, you know, it's in you and you can find it and I believe in you, but you have to stumble and fall and get up and do these things to figure out who you are and what's really attractive to you. What I saw every day was a dad going off to work, coming home and not being angry at the boss or upset at something that happened. He loved what he did. And at the same time, it wasn't because of the money. We didn't see the money being spent and, you know, trying to make us look like we were more important than somebody else or any of that stuff. He just loved his work and it happened to make a lot of money.
And in pursuing your life path, that ended up being music for you, being a composer, being a musician. I believe you actually won an Emmy, I think.
I did. I won a couple of regional Emmys, so they're not the national ones, but I did. Yeah, a couple of Emmys. I scored a piece of music for the film Dances with Wolves, which is a huge success. And so I did, in fact, find my own path.
But the trajectory of your life changed once again. In 2004, your mother passed.
Right.
And you inherited a certain amount of money.
Right.
And so that allowed you just to start your charity?
Well, it's
or did you start it before that?
Well, my parents wanted to sort of prime the pump, even though I don't know if they even knew they were doing it for sure. But in 1999, they gave my siblings and myself, there's three of us, I'm the youngest of three, all foundations, just to see if we were interested in doing that sort of thing.
Was it a pre-existing foundation?
No, it was actually for each of us, we got a $10 million gift, which is an extraordinary gift. Of course, we had to give that money away. There's a rule basically where you have to spend 5% of that every year, right? So it was manageable. It was a lot of money, but it wasn't outrageous. It wasn't until after my mother passed away in 2004 that in 2006, my dad made the large gesture of essentially giving all his money away. And my sister, my brother, and I all got billion-dollar foundations. That was life-changing.
In 2006, Peter Buffett reconstituted his existing foundation that was created in the late 90s. He changed its name to the Novo Foundation.
So we changed it to the Novo Foundation because Novo was more indicative of the true nature of what we were trying to do. Novo in Latin means to create change. And that's what we found was the best way to describe what we were trying to do. We can't make change happen. And I also think change is going to happen in the creative realms. We have to use our imagination to get to where we want to go. I have a hard time with reforming anything. I think it's bigger than that.
What is at the core of the work of that foundation?
The mission is essentially to be a change agent to create a world that instead of being based on domination and exploitation, moves to a world of collaboration and partnership, seeing girls and women as one of the primary agents of that change. So the bigger vision is we live in a world of transactions, not relationships. And how do we change that? How do we start to live in a world of loving, nurturing, supportive, equity, justice, like all the things we hear about, but we don't see very often on a daily basis. And the clear indicators from our perspective that this begins with girls and women, that if you support a girl and she has agency over her life, everybody's going to be better off. Only a girl is the mother of every child. And so you got to start there.
So essentially, your foundation deals with girl and women equity and justice issues?
Yeah, around ending violence, giving more possibilities to girls and women, always essentially the most marginalized, because I think you have to start in the deepest places to get everybody, all boats to rise, essentially. But it also focuses on something that some people call social emotional learning. How do we get a different school climate so we can, again, raise kids as whole children and not just teaching to the test? Kind of the third leg of the stool is local living economies. How do we create more resilient, caring, nurturing communities for everybody? So those three things, girls and women being the largest focus, and then the other two areas.
What's interesting about your foundation is your work is not just domestic, it's international in scope. Can you talk about some of the areas that you address? I know one of them is sex trafficking.
Right. That's a big one. And again, there is no more kind of brutal and a literal version of being a transaction versus a relationship than trafficking. If we can sell another human being, it allows for almost every other egregious act to happen. And in general, and this was my dad's only directive, really, go places other people won't, because otherwise you're just doing the things that everybody else does, right? And so we found that trafficking, child sexual abuse, you know, the darker areas of things that people don't seem to want to talk about, which is understandable, actually. It's not a subject you want to bring up at a cocktail party necessarily, but it's happening down the street. And that's the important thing, too, is that this is not something in just a far-off land, although it happens there. We've been to India, Bangladesh, Sierra Leone, Liberia, you know, all sorts of places that are the kind of front lines of what would maybe appear to be the most intense parts of this work. But the truth is, whether it's New York, Atlanta, Chicago, And I will guarantee somewhere in Kalamazoo, it's happening. And that's what we're trying to get to the root of, is how can our society allow this to happen? And what are the best ways to end it?
We've been talking with philanthropist Peter Buffett on West Southwest. His Novo Foundation also supports projects in the United States.
On our shores in the U.S. in particular, you have a movement that deals with domestic and sexual violence, including child sexual abuse.
There's something we're supporting called the Move to End Violence, which is a 10-year program. And this is the kind of thing that we're trying to also exemplify as a foundation, is these are issues that can end, but they need long-term support and consistent support. And they need to bring, and this is where Move to End Violence comes in, the actors working in the field together in a way that is not competitive. Because usually what you find are all these people working really hard, very passionate around these subject matters, and they themselves don't allow for self-care and interaction because they're all competing for the same dollars. It's such a rarefied air in terms of the people working on this, that, like I said, they're in competition with each other. So to create a long-term multi-cohort initiative that will bring these people together and give them self-care, leadership training, cross-pollinization in terms of ideas and thoughts, and a true, you know, weaving together the collaboration part of what we try and do. We don't know what will happen because of that. But that's, again, the core of our work. We're not saying we know how to fix this. We're saying the people that are doing this know how to fix it. And so we should support them in ways that maybe they've never been supported before.
One thing that I find fascinating about your foundation is that you try to partner with others.
Right.
You don't try to reinvent the wheel.
Exactly.
I believe you're partnering with the Ms. Foundation.
Right. For the child sexual abuse part.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Yes.
Exactly. I mean, one of the great things we've realized in retrospect is that we didn't inherit an institution. We started, Jennifer and I, from scratch. So we could build this from the ground up in a way that might be different, that might use, again, not just the money as a tool, but how we behaved, and frankly, our last name. We could get attention, and if we behave differently, it might show that there are other ways foundations can work with people, for people, as opposed to being the, you know, the leader in something and being the one to show off what it can do when it's supposed to be about other people.
The charge that your father gave you when he gave the $1 billion gift back in 2006.
Yeah.
What was the general loose parameters of that?
Typical of my dad, there weren't any. I mean, again, there, and it's interesting, the letter to each of us is online. And so it says very little about what to do other than try and be daring, essentially, try and go places where other people won't. And again, my dad is extraordinary that way. It's how he runs his business. He finds great managers and says, "You're great. Do what you do. I'm not going to get in the way." And so it's a wonderful underwriting of, you know, of us to say, go out and figure it out. And so Jennifer and I, of course, like my siblings, took that very seriously and spent a good 2, maybe 3 years in what felt like graduate school. You know, we were, you know, it's funny when you have a $1 billion foundation, you're better looking and your jokes are funnier. But the truth is you can attract people to talk to. And we were in New York. And so we spent a lot of time listening and learning from others. And again, I think it's from growing up in my dad's household, he always was looking for the undervalued asset. And he would take days, months, years, poring over all these various books and investment manuals and things, looking for the thing that nobody else saw that was the undervalued asset. The thing that if he invested in and just waited, he didn't have to do anything, that the market would then see its value and go, and the price would rise, the stock would rise, and he would make money based on his insight years, sometimes decades before. So kind of armed with that way of thinking, it became pretty clear pretty quickly that the adolescent girl is the undervalued asset in our world, you know, that if you invest in her, she'll do the rest.
Because a lot of people weren't focusing in this area.
No, not surprisingly, not then and not now.
What benchmarks will you see that you will know that you're closer to arriving at what your goals are?
That's a great question.
Because some of the things I think that you're probably trying to attempt, especially in other countries, deal with a cultural shift.
Yeah.
And that can be hard.
That can be hard. And even here, it's a mindset that is a difficult one to shift. And I say often to the folks at the foundation, these are generational things, and much of what we're working on we'll never see the results of. So what you do see are the small wins. When you talk to a girl that was trafficked and now she's not, and she's telling you that she's going to school and she's got this life ahead of her, you look at those small things and you believe that they're going to turn out to be big things in the future. But we live in a world of quarterly reports and, you know, what's happening now. And at the foundation, we try and remove our brains from that as much as possible. You do have to have benchmarks and ways to quantify some things, but I believe that can really get you into a trap. And because we don't have anyone to answer to but ourselves, we don't have to live in that trap. So we would rather put money into things we believe in and intuit to be correct, knowing that we won't see a lot of answers, but that we will get little wins along the way.
You had a op-ed piece in the New York Times, I think it was in 2013. It was called The Charitable Industrial Complex,
right,
in which you criticized, quote unquote, philanthropic colonialism.
Right.
What is that?
Early on in our learning journey, that was these first few years after 2006, I would listen to the stories of mostly the NGOs out in the world getting the money to do the work, and that highly committed people, you know, doing what they believe is right, but that these donors would come in and tell them what they think they should do, or that they could not use money for instance, general operating support. They could only use it for a program. And then there was the frustration, well, how do we keep the lights on and the telephones working and things like that? So this control from above, essentially, was so obvious to me. And in one meeting with a group, I just blurted out, well, that sounds like philanthropic colonialism. And everybody got excited and said, somebody said it.
Well, Mr. Buffett, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to philanthropist Peter Buffett. He and his wife are working on a book about what they've learned about philanthropy and the 10 years of running the Novo Foundation. For a longer version of this interview, visit WMUK.org. For West Southwest on WMUK, I'm Earlene McMichael.